This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
New media has become old media in the AOL Huffington Post deal. The relationship between the White House and the business community has become a four-letter word. Also, global warming. Please, try to stay with us now, will you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 7th of February. Good to have you with us. All right, so MapQuest, right? That's what this whole Huffington Post AOL deal is about. Arianna Huffington took $315 million from AOL because she just couldn't wait to get her hands on AOL's map site. Okay, so that's not true, but MapQuest is one teeny little part of what is now to be called the Huffington Post Media Group. The HuffPo gets some solid financial footing from the deal, news of which broke last night. AOL's news operation gets a shot in the arm, and we get Ken Auletta on the phone. He's the media writer for The New Yorker magazine. Ken, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
So this thing hit like a bombshell last night. Much surprise, but in retrospect, is it really?
No, I don't think it was, because the truth is, if you, each party had a real incentive to do a deal. In AOL's case, I mean, all of their numbers in their quarterly reports that they've been issuing, including one as recently as a little over a week ago, show that the revenues were declining. Their subscribers were declining. And yet Tim Armstrong, the dynamic new CEO at AOL, had promised that you would see a positive turnaround at AOL in the second half of this year. And yet the numbers weren't showing that way. So he had to throw a long pass, and Huffington Post a long pass.
I read a post on GigaOM, the website, this morning that basically compared this move to the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, when Robert Redford and Paul Newman jump off that cliff with the whole Bolivian army behind him. Right?
I wouldn't compare it to that. I would compare it to a fourth quarter attempt to throw a touchdown pass. I don't think he's jumping off not knowing whether he's going to die when he lands. But he was challenged. AOL is challenged. On the other hand, Huffington Post had an incentive to do a deal in that any startup company, if they want to expand, needs deep pockets. And they didn't have deep pockets. So they either had to go out to investors and raise more money or do an IPO or sell the company. And they chose to do the latter.
With each side then getting what you say they want out of this deal, does Arianna Huffington now become sort of the empress of all new media?
She might like to portray it that way. Well, she becomes more important, though. I mean, she is the editor-in-chief of all of AOL's content properties, and that means not just Huffington Post, but it includes their hyperlocal sites called Patch. There are over 800 of those. It includes, you know, TechCrunch and Engadget and all the other things, Movie Phone, all the other sites that AOL has. She has a much bigger platform today than she had yesterday, no question about that. But there are a lot of vibrant sites that are separate from AOL and Huffington Post on the web.
Is the $315 million that Tim Armstrong paid for Huffington Post sort of a big check for what is, in essence, a glorified but well-curated blog?
Well, it's a blog that, A, has 200 employees. It's a blog that claims it's making money now. And clearly, if you look at its growth of monthly visitors, that's growing. Monthly hits, that's growing. So Huffington Post today is perceived as a new media darling the way AOL was a dozen years ago. The ironic thing here is that AOL is the old media company now buying into a new media company.
Yeah, but here's the thing. The last time AOL was involved in this big deal, when it was the new media company in the AOL Time Warner deal, we all know how that worked out, and that was lousy.
We did. And by the way, we heard some of the same arguments.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, Jerry Levin, who was the head of Time Warner, and Steve Case, who was the head of AOL, were literally saying 1 plus 1 equals 11 or 12, which is exactly what Tim Armstrong and Arianna Huffington are saying today. They were great believers in synergy. So is Arianna Huffington and Tim Armstrong. Will those synergies come to pass? Complicated. Who knows? But we know this. What was overlooked in the AOL deal is that you were trying to combine two companies who had two very distinct and different cultures. Is that true today between AOL and Huffington Post? We're going to find out.
Ken Auletta, he's a media writer for The New Yorker magazine. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
On Wall Street today, investors didn't much care for that Huffington Post deal. AOL shares lost 3.5%. Major indices did just fine, though. Details, numbers, when we get there. There's a big sign on the front of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building in Washington, D.C. So big a sign, it was probably pretty tough for the president to miss as he paid a visit to the chamber for his big speech this morning. J-O-B-S, it says, in billboard-sized letters. And that pretty much summarizes the common economic ground between the administration and the business community nowadays. So the president tried to offer a deal in his speech. I give you incentives, he said, like tax breaks, eh? You go out and hire people. So it sounds simple, which of course means it's not. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer was at the speech. She filed this report.
The White House and Chamber of Commerce face each other across Lafayette Square, but they've been anything but neighborly. The president acknowledged they feuded over the health care and financial overhauls.
If we had brought over a fruitcake when I first moved in, we would have gotten off to a better start. But I'm going to make up for it.
In lieu of fruitcake, the president said he'd work to cut corporate taxes, build new roads and bridges, and foster innovation. In return, the president said U.S. businesses should hire new workers now.
If there is a reason that you don't believe that this is the time to get off the sidelines, to hire and to invest, I want to know about it. I want to fix it.
But how do you fix intangibles like businesses' lack of confidence or that the most robust growth isn't happening here? Kerry Leahy is an economist with Decision Economics. He says companies aren't hiring because...
No firm wants to stick its neck out thinking that they'll go back into the abyss in 2 years. So there is this understandable reluctance to do anything but sit in your hands.
Back at the Chamber of Commerce, Juliana Efesiu says she liked the speech. She owns a small consulting business. Did she hear anything that would make her hire somebody tomorrow? Well, no, she doesn't have immediate hiring plans. But even if she did, she doesn't think she could get a line of credit.
So I hope that those lines will be open and that small business will be able, with a sound business plan, to have banks invest in their businesses.
But economist Leahy says there's only so much the government can do to instill confidence. And the chamber's chief lobbyist, Bruce Joston, isn't sure exactly what the president will accomplish.
I am always hopeful to work with the White House and that they will act on their rhetoric.
But at least the two neighbors are talking again. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The only thing Google has had to say about the protests in Egypt came today. The company expressed, quote, huge relief. The key Google marketing executive for the Middle East has been released. He'd been detained in Egypt since late January. He vanished just a couple of days after the protests began. And his very public support for the political opposition there put Google in an interesting position, astride the fine line between corporate interests and political activism. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Google executive Wael Ghanim's Twitter protest updates from Egypt helped to make him a hero with anti-government protesters, but his political stance could be problematic for Google. It wants to do business in Egypt, but it also has to maintain credibility with its users. Kenneth Rogoff's an economics professor at Harvard University.
The typical person using Google wants to think that they're getting the best information out there. And if they don't, they might look for someone else to give it to them.
The search giant hasn't commented on whether it approves of Ghanim's actions, but it did launch a service to help Egyptians use Twitter when internet service was restricted by the government. Ishwar Prasad at the Brookings Institution says Ghanim's actions are consistent with Google's corporate philosophy.
It's a very unnerving prospect if, in fact, other types of companies like Google that are all about information flow are going to be taken to task just for providing channels for their information flow.
Prasad says emerging markets with authoritarian regimes present unique challenges to information companies like Google.
Given the populations and the rising incomes, these are going to be much larger markets someday than the U.S. I think it's very difficult for them to stick so much to principles that they lose access to these markets.
Google ran up against this problem in China last year. The government wanted Google to self-censor searches on its Chinese website. A compromise was reached, but Google's formerly growing market share in Chinese search has since cooled. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Christina Aguilera got the lyrics to the Star Spangled Banner wrong. The NFL had to turn away 400 paying customers because some temporary seating areas weren't ready by kickoff time. But hey, down on the field, it actually was a heck of a ball game. The Packers beat the Steelers last night in what, by my count, was the eighth pretty good Super Bowl in a row. Early estimates are that it broke last year's television audience record, and certainly the people who run the numbers in the NFL's business office are going to be pleased about that. But hold the phone for just a second here, because the league's collective bargaining agreement with the players expires on March the 3rd. So, are you ready for no NFL football? Commentator and sports writer John Wertheim imagines what that might look like.
We should start by reflecting on the good that would come in the absence of the NFL. Church attendance would soar, the Detroit Lions would lose no games, 60 Minutes would air at its regularly scheduled time. But some sectors are sure to take a huge hit. For one, a lot of beer will go unconsumed. Bars and restaurants that do a brisk business on Sunday would suffer. So would the banks, and in some cases cities, awaiting debt service on empty stadiums. Television would absorb an immense hit. The networks dispense billions for NFL games, and are the source in many ways of this labor kerfuffle to start with. At a time of diminishing ratings, the NFL is singularly robust programming. The biggest loser, pardon the pun, might be NBC. Many weeks, the Sunday NFL telecast was the only show the network had in the top 25. The $2 billion fantasy football market would be decimated. Similarly, the absence of the NFL would be bad for Vegas, to say nothing of the local bookie. It's no coincidence that the country's most popular sport, by far, is also the most popular gambling sport, by far. The Super Bowl alone can generate $100 million in legal wagers. Gambling experts contend that illegal NFL wagers could top $100 billion in a season. No games, no gaming. The real loser, though, might ultimately be the NFL. Yes, the league is solid economically, but it's on shakier grounds culturally. The majority of NFL fans have never played a down of football. It's just another reality show with big hits, big personalities, and great use of cameras. When it's off the air, fans will gravitate elsewhere.
John Wertheim's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's also the co-author of a new book called Scorecasting, The Hidden Influence Behind How Sports Are Played and How Games Are Won. Share your thoughts with us on whatever you like, not just sports. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. And now, let's do the numbers. Mergers and profits galore took markets higher today. The Dow Industrials climbed 69 points, 0.5%, closed at 12,161. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, 0.5%, 2783 at the bell. The S&P 500 lifted 8 points, 0.6%, finished at 1319, the highest watermark since June 2008, if you happen to be keeping track. Danaher decided to buy the medical diagnostics company Beckman Coulter for $6.8 billion, the maker of everything from hand tools to code bars. Picked up more than 2%. Beckman Coulter diagnosed a 10% uptick in its stock price. Oil driller Ensco said it would buy Pride International. Ensco drained off a little more than 4% today. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The FCC is scheduled to meet and discuss the rollout of broadband to rural America. The National Association of Workforce Boards hosts the Dialogue for Workforce Excellence in Washington, D.C. I'm sure the event staff will be on its most excellent behavior. And on February 8, 1963, the John F. Kennedy administration banned travel and all financial transactions with Cuba. I'm Preeti Upadhyay.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. People gotta eat is a pretty solid business model. But in Egypt the past couple of weeks, the business of food has been a little bit different. Grocery stores and their suppliers have been at the mercy of what's been happening out on the streets, none of which has been conducive to the bottom line. The natural foods company Wadi Foods is headquartered in Cairo. They sell Egyptian olive oil, for instance, both at home and elsewhere in the Middle East. Khalil Nasrallah is one of the company's co-founders. Mr. Nasrallah, welcome to the broadcast.
Good to be with you.
I guess the most basic question, sir, is how has business been for you these past couple of weeks?
Well, the business was shut down, so if this answers your question. Yesterday was the first real working day, and today was, I would say, close to 70-80% normal.
What about your clients, your customers, the people to whom you sell your food products and the people that you buy from? Have they been able to have any kind of normal business?
Most of them are back in business. I wouldn't say they're back to almost normal. They're starting to place their orders and we're starting to deliver. But the main one that was hit badly was the hotel business, and we are suffering over there.
Have you had security concerns about your business? It has been, as we've all seen on television, it's been rough.
We did face quite a bit of challenge, especially when the police left the streets and a lot of looting happened, and the prisoners were let out of the prisons, and we had to protect our farms and our factories and our offices. This was the biggest challenge we faced.
Tell me about that. How do you protect your property when things like this happen?
Well, we were lucky that our employees were at the factory and at the farm at the time, and instead of them doing their daily work, we asked them to help us protect the farm and the factory, which they did amazingly well. We created shifts to man the gates and the fences on 24-hour basis, and everything went very well, actually.
Is it possible to tell yet how much money you've lost and how much this revolution in the streets is costing you?
The early estimates that we've run today and yesterday will bring the losses around $200,000. Now, we didn't really see the long-term effect of this problem, so it might be more than this.
Will you change your business strategy at all? I mean, you sell food into local Egyptian markets, but you export as well into regional markets in the Middle East, yes?
Yes, exactly. We do export. And I think to compensate for the losses in the local market, we will have to export more products. Now, it might be also beneficial to export these days because the exchange rate is in our favor.
For all the recent troubles, Egypt has been, in most regards, a stable place to do business the past number of years, hasn't it?
Yes. Egypt, for the past 2 years, has been doing really well when many countries in the world were suffering from the economic meltdown. And we have seen a lot of businesses and factories coming up in this country, a lot of investment in real estate that we have seen over the past 2 years. And we still expect this to go on, even with the troubles that we've seen.
If it doesn't recover, Mr. Nasrallah, will you stay or will you leave?
I think we have a lot at stake in this country, and we have a very firm belief that it will recover. But if it becomes impossible to live here, then we'll have to make a decision. But right now, we are staying put.
Khalil Nasrallah, talking to us from Cairo. He's the co-founder of Wadi Foods there. Mr. Nasrallah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We still don't know exactly what's going to happen with the government and the economy in Egypt, but it has been almost 3 weeks since Tunisians decided what they wanted to do. After forcing President Ben Ali into exile, they've had to figure out how to put their country back together again. And right up there on the list of challenges is undoing what 23 years of official corruption has done to their economy. Sabri Benishour reports now from Tunis.
A couple of weeks after Tunisia's former president fled the country, a sign that used to read Ministry of Finance was crossed out and read instead Ministry of Thieves. Protesters were railing against what's known as rashwa, or corruption. Noura Khouidi is an Arabic major in Tunis.
I work hard. I spend nights. I look forward to doing many things for my family. And then when I finish my studies, there is an exam, which is a nightmare. You must bribe people in order to get it.
Everybody seems to have a story about rashwa, paying a bribe to get a passport, a legal document, a job, even government subsidies. Tunisians trace the source of this culture of corruption through a familiar proverb.
A rotten fish starts from the head.
That's Maher Khalel. He says the ultimate rotten fish head was Zine Ben Ali, Tunisia's former dictator and his family. Khalel is an investment advisor for Poulinot, Tunisia's largest holding company. They trade in everything from toothpaste to mufflers to chickens. He said corruption trickled down from the Ben Ali family through the ruling party and down into society at large.
If the manager does that, then I also can do that. This is how corruption is created. If the boss is using privileges for his family, then also I should do the same.
Khalel said Ben Ali targeted Poulinot with bogus audits and then personally offered to make them go away if Poulinot paid $35 million.
And we paid.
Worse, Maher said, was what he calls a parallel economy, where friends and family of the former dictator could get out of paying import taxes and undercut domestic producers.
For my calculus, is that we lost 2 to 3 points at least of growth.
In the lobby of a former bank in downtown Tunis, a throng of very upset people is waiting to testify. This is the National Commission on Corruption and Embezzlement, set up by the new provisional government. Abdel Fattah Amor, a former UN special reporter for human rights, was appointed to run it. He's gotten close to 1,000 formal complaints in just a few days.
I hope we won't be drowned by all this demand.
The plan is to document, investigate, and then prosecute as many cases as possible. He has no idea how long that will take. The biggest challenge is the pervasiveness of the problem.
What is fundamentally important is that we develop a new culture of integrity and property.
Tunisians sent a strong message that that's the culture they want. And while they acknowledge it certainly won't happen overnight, they see promise in the fact that the rotten fish head of Zine Ben Ali and his cronies is gone. In Tunis, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
I'm going to say a couple of things now by way of setting up this next story that I can only hope won't make you turn off the radio. Here we go. Global warming and greenhouse gas emissions. If you're still with me, first of all, thank you. Second of all, the tendency to tune out when people start talking about climate change is actually pretty widespread. A report from Pew shows only about a quarter of Americans think global warming is a top priority. Lobbying, financial regulation, and moral decline all rank higher. And that has environmental and climate groups scrambling to get people to care. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
It's hard to sex up a topic as sciencey and scary as billions of tons of pollution causing our world to heat up. Not that some groups haven't tried.
Glaciers are melting.
Sea levels are rising.
Dry places have droughts.
We need to cool off.
And to cool off, the ads feature hot models stripping down. Way down. Compelling, I'll leave that to you. But coming up with a message that resonates with people and makes them care about our warming planet can be tough, especially because it's so complicated.
Talking about any scientific issue and doing it in a way that motivates people to take action will be a challenge.
Jamie Hinn is the co-founder of 350.org, an activist group focused on the climate. He says to really get people thinking about the environment, you've got to tie it to issues like jobs and the economy that are more top of mind.
Finding a way to take this global problem and bring it back down to a human scale as much as possible.
One strategy that doesn't seem to have worked so far, focusing on all the horrible things that might happen if we don't act. Consider one of the environmental movement's biggest ad failures from the climate group 1010 UK. In it, kids who don't want to participate in a plan to reduce pollution get blown up.
Now, everybody, please remember to read chapters 5 and 6 on volcanoes and glaciation.
Except for Philip and Tracy, of course.
It's not just the grossness that makes messages like this fail. There are psychological and social reasons that doomy, gloomy, end-of-the-world messages don't work. Rob Willer is a sociology professor at UC Berkeley.
There is this general tendency of people, and Americans especially, to believe in the world as just and fair and orderly.
Willer says apocalyptic climate messages can challenge that core belief.
And when information arises that threatens that view of the world, people tend to disregard that information.
Willer's study found people with strong senses of a just world were less likely to believe that climate is changing when it was presented in really dire ways. His advice for organizations working on campaigns? Be honest, but be positive. Tom Bowman is the president of Bowman Global Change. He works with scientists on coming up with ways to talk about their work. He says the conversation needs to move away from the problems to solutions.
I would move beyond that conversation and talk about how are we going to solve this? What does it mean to us to solve it?
Bowman says it's time to rebrand climate change, dump the downer impending environmental catastrophe image, and instead come up with something more inspiring, a promising new way forward for the country.
It could be about a new patriotism. It could be about transforming ourselves to be the world leader in the new economy.
Perhaps visions that would garner attention without the addition of nearly nude models. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by monitoring and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a last word for the season and some perspective on the ridiculousness of Super Bowl ads. More specifically, how much money companies spend on them. Barry Ritholtz at his blog The Big Picture annualized the $2.8 million or so that 30 seconds of airtime during the game costs. How much that would be in a year at that rate of spending. Here you go, $3.2 trillion. And here's the perspective part. The entire German economy, the biggest in Europe, $3.3 trillion. My favorite, by the way, of all those ads, M&M and Chrysler, hands down. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 69 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 14 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 lifted 8 points, 0.6%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, the economic pain is still hanging around, so what's the plan?
I've been well advised.
not to use the word pain and not to use the word painful. Those words cause pain, and those words are painful.
Ouch. How to handle the hurt, Freakonomics style. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.